Ya şeyi çekersin değil mi? Resmimizi.
Well, welcome everyone to tonight's event. My name's Gary Simpson. I'm the chair of international law here at the LSC, and this event is being co-sponsored by the Department of Government and the Human Rights Center. And the topic is universal jurisdiction versus political immunity. Can states still get away with it? And at least as far as the British legal system goes, this story goes back at least as far as the Pinochet case in the late 1990s, which you'll all be familiar with, and some of the principles in that case will no doubt be important here. But the proximate case of interest for us is the case involving the Marvin Marmara in 2010. And we are at an interesting moment in the history of that case because the criminal court in Istanbul will be deciding whether to go ahead with criminal proceedings under a principle of universal jurisdiction arising out of the attack on the flotilla in the context of a recent agreement between the Israeli state and the Turkish state to suspend those proceedings. So it's a rather interesting moment where there's a clash between what look like the imperatives of diplomacy and the imperatives of criminal justice. So we've got an all-star panel tonight to discuss these issues from a very wide variety of different perspectives, and we're delighted that they've all agreed to speak. So the order will be as follows. Everyone will have around 10 minutes, and I will enforce that quite strictly because otherwise it will be a very, very long night. We do have 2 hours allocated, and we want to maximize the amount of time you have for questions as well. So the first speaker will be Rodney Dixon, QC, on my immediate left, who works at Temple Garden Chambers and is representing victims on the flotilla and the Marvin Marmara. So we're delighted to have him here. Ahmet Doğan, who was the father of, is the father of Furkan Doğan, who was an 18-year-old activist killed on the Marvin Marmara, will speak in Turkish, and there will be a translator present as well, Hakan, who will help us with that. So thank you very much for that. The third speaker is Ali Emre Bozabayandir, who's an associate professor of international law and international criminal law and the assistant dean at Istanbul's Sabahattin Zaim University. We're very pleased to have him here too. Our fourth speaker is Alexandra Lord Phillips, who was a British activist on board the Gaza flotilla, so we look forward to hearing her perspective. And then the final speaker is our sort of impresario for the evening, Dr. John Shalcroft, the associate professor in history and politics of empire here at the LSC Department of Government, who's been very much central to the success of putting together this particular evening. So thank you, John, in advance. And Rodney, I'll hand over to you now.
Thank you, sir. Well, good evening all. Thank you very much. We have an extremely difficult question to answer tonight, which is whether universal jurisdiction is under threat. My answer, looking at it from a legal point of view, is yes, no, and maybe. I'm covering myself entirely, but you'll see why in due course. Yes, it certainly is under threat when we consider this agreement that has been mentioned between Israel and Turkey, a recent agreement specifically in relation to the Gaza Freedom Flotilla. It doesn't cover anything else in that region of the world. And it is an agreement which in essence says that we will pay, that's Israel, $20 million to the families of the deceased. There were 10 of those on the flotilla. Says nothing about those people who were tortured, mistreated, wrongfully imprisoned, had their goods stolen. It only mentions the 10 deceased. And the agreement is, in return for that, there will be no apology issued, there will be no admission as to accountability or responsibility, and all criminal and civil proceedings in Turkey and involving Turkish nationals will be halted. And it goes even further than that and says, if anyone tries to take things further, well, the Turkish government will indemnify the Israeli government against any claims that are brought. The agreement is available online. Have a look at it. I'm not going to do a boring legal analysis of it. That's, in essence, what it amounts to. So the first answer is yes. If you're looking at the principle of universal jurisdiction, it is seriously imperiled by this agreement because you have both Turkish nationals and many other nationals who were on board the flotilla who can no longer pursue their criminal and civil claims in Turkey. So for Turkish nationals, it takes away their right and access to their own courts. For those outside of Turkey, internationals, it takes away their right to universal jurisdiction, which does exist in Turkey, as it does here in the UK, for war crimes committed in an international armed conflict and for torture. So it would be like the government here saying, well, for a particular incident in a certain country, you as UK nationals cannot go to court, both criminally and civilly. Our prosecutors will not look into this. And also internationals who can use universal jurisdiction principles are stopped from doing that in the UK. That's what it amounts to. Now, the court has to decide in Turkey on how to apply this agreement. It will be doing that on Friday, the 2nd of December. We expect the decision then. It may be that it is delayed, but very strong submissions are going to be put forward there by the lawyers in Turkey arguing that they should uphold the rule of law, they should uphold the Turkish constitution, and they should abide by the European Convention on Human Rights, which guarantees access to courts. Turkey signed up to that. And international law generally, which as a whole does not recognize amnesties and immunities for the most serious war crimes, crimes against humanity. So that case will be put on Friday, and we'll see what the outcome is. If it is a negative one, if the courts buckle under the political pressure, then there will be routes in Turkey to appeal, to go to the Constitutional Court. We'll hear more about that soon from our expert Turkish lawyer. And potentially thereafter to the European Court of Human Rights itself. This will be one of the very first times that a government and two governments have acted in this way, to through a political agreement amongst themselves, through a treaty essentially, a bilateral treaty, seek to prevent the courts from intervening. So it will certainly be an interesting matter for the European Court to consider. Now, the other part of my answer is no, a universal jurisdiction is not under threat entirely by this agreement because it is on its face limited to Turkey. And we have on behalf of the victims a number of other cases outside of Turkey which remain completely unaffected by this decision. And it would be legally completely without any basis for other courts to try and rely on this treaty to stop what's happening in their courts. So, for example, most importantly, at the International Criminal Court in The Hague, we have proceedings going on behalf of the victims, and in particular on behalf of the government of Comoros, which is a state party to the ICC, who have referred the matter to the ICC prosecutor to investigate. She has so far said that she is not going to do that because although war crimes were committed, she found, it's not a serious enough case, she said, for the ICC. That was judicially reviewed by the judges and found to be wrong, and she is now reconsidering that matter. Now, she should not take into account an agreement by the governments involved. It has nothing to do with the ICC's jurisdiction, and she has to decide independently whether or not she should continue with this matter and open up a full investigation. We also have cases that are ongoing in the US, including Mr. Dogan's case on behalf of his son who was tragically killed on the top deck of the Mavi Marmara. And that is a civil claim under the Alien Tort Statute and the Torture Victims Protection Act, which, although not strictly speaking universal forms of jurisdiction, they do allow for actions like this because of the statute to be brought in UK courts, even though the crimes occurred elsewhere. So that case is ongoing, as is the case against the State of Israel itself, which is possible to bring because one of the ships was a US flagged ship. So although not strictly speaking universal jurisdiction, another case where it took place outside of the US's borders but on a US ship, and therefore under the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, this action is continuing. So these remain unaffected, as does a case in the UK, which the police are investigating here, under our own universal jurisdiction provisions. If the police decide that they are able to investigate and charge, then if any of those responsible travel to the UK, they can be arrested in much the same way as Pinochet was arrested when he came here. Torture was the basis for that, universal jurisdiction, and the fact that he was no longer in office, none of the suspects in this case are in office either, means that the state can't assert any official immunity. The fact that you were in office at the time when you committed the acts is not a bar to the courts here exercising jurisdiction, especially in relation to torture, which in fact by definition requires official acts. You need to be in an official position to be charged with torture. And certainly all the suspects in this case were in such a position. So the answer is also no, and these actions will continue regardless. The maybe is, well, what kind of precedent would this set if it goes ahead? And if at the end of the day it is not overturned at some stage in the process, either in Turkey or at the European Court, it's potentially one that is very undermining to universal jurisdiction if it goes ahead. It's a maybe because it'll be a test for those in other conflicts to decide whether they would ever follow a precedent like this. At the moment, for example, in countries like Syria, where people are crying out for international justice, would it be possible for the key players to enter into some kind of agreement that compensation would be paid, but there would be no trials in order to get peace in that region? Now, this isn't a totally foreign concept altogether, and we must take into account when we discuss this issue that there have been situations where justice has been sacrificed to some extent for overriding peace considerations. I think of South Africa, for example, where there were no trials following the end of apartheid, but that was arguably very different to the current situation because it was the victims themselves, through their own processes and adopting a new constitution, that decided that would be the case. Amnesties would be given. In this case, and in many others, there's been no consultation at all with the victims. In fact, they've been entirely excluded from the process, as was the case in Chile with Pinochet. Giving himself an amnesty wasn't regarded as something that could be upheld in a court of law. It may be different, however, if it comes directly from the victims in certain circumstances. But even then in South Africa, it wasn't a complete amnesty. Those who didn't participate and cooperate and didn't tell the truth could still be prosecuted. So we just have to bear that in mind when we look at this. There's a maybe. In some situations, universal jurisdiction may be sacrificed, but I would argue very strongly that that is limited, and it depends entirely on the will of the victims in any particular situation. It has to be genuine and based on proper considerations that are lawful. Also, what we need to take into account is what the latent effect of this agreement might be if it's upheld by the Turkish courts. Those in the US, those at the ICC, subliminally might think that the case is now resolved. It can be put away because there has been an agreement. Some money has been put on the table. And that's the way the parties might well portray this, that you can now put this to bed. And that could have an effect on the ICC. It could have an effect on U.S. judges. These institutions are not immune to broader developments. They are only human after all, and they could be affected by that. And it's up to those involved, the lawyers and the victims, to make sure that the proper processes are followed. So there is a maybe category as well. I think yes, no, and maybe all apply. But I think what we are striving for is to ensure that there is a no across the board, both in the courts of Turkey, but certainly in the other institutions at the ICC. I want to just end off, because I think it's important to emphasize something that came from the ICC judges themselves in their decision when they told the prosecutor that she had got it wrong. And they stress, this is the last paragraph, it's their decision of 16 July 2015, which you should certainly look at to get a very good account of how the prosecutor was criticized for not taking this case on. They said, as a final note, the chamber cannot overlook the discrepancy between, on the one hand, the prosecutor's conclusion that the identified crimes were so evidently not grave enough to justify the court's intervention, of which its raison d'etre is to investigate and prosecute serious international crimes, and then on the other hand, the attention and concern that these events attracted from the parties involved, also leading to several fact-finding efforts on behalf of states and the United Nations in order to shed light on these events. The judges were very aware of all of the activities that had been undertaken by so many organizations, by so many activists, by so many lawyers, to highlight the seriousness of this at the international level, that so many states had been involved, that it was a matter of international concern. And that's, after all, what universal jurisdiction is there to guarantee, that for the most serious crimes, it doesn't matter which country they occur in. Universally, there has to be justice, and there cannot be an impunity gap. The chamber ended off by saying that it was confident that the prosecutor would fully uphold her mandate. We are hoping that she will. We are hoping the courts in Turkey will as well and do the right thing. Thank you.
Hepinize iyi akşamlar diliyorum.
Abişoğlu, good evening.
İsmim Ahmet Doğan.
Buyurunuz Ahmet Doğan.
Türkiye'de öğretim üyesiyim.
I'm an academic in Turkey.
Mavi Marmara'da İsrail tarafından katledilen geminin de en küçük yolcusu olan Furkan'ın da babasıyım.
I am father of Furkan, who is the youngest member of the passengers of the Mavi Marmara, who was killed by Israeli soldiers.
Furkan evimizin en küçüğüydü, üçüncü evladımızdı.
He was the youngest member of my family, and he was the third child of our family.
Liseyi henüz bitirmişti ve üniversite sınavına girmişti.
He just graduated high school and took part in his examination for university place.
Çok başarılı ve çok çalışkan bir evladımızdı.
He was very successful student and he was a hard-working child.
Sınav sonucu Türkiye'nin bir nolu en başarılı tıp fakültesini kazanmıştı.
After his exam results came, we found that he won the place in the number one medical university institution in Turkey.
Amacı göz doktor olmak
ve insanlara yardım etmek, özellikle de Afrika'daki yoksulların, mağdurların katarakt ameliyatlarını yapmayı hedefliyordu. Yeryüzü doktorlarıyla dolaşmayı hedeflemişti.
He wanted to be an eye doctor. His dream was to become a doctor and then help especially people in Africa, young children or people in Africa. He wanted to tour Africa with medicine and so forth there, Doctors Without Borders, and help people in Africa and heal them and help them out.
Furkan gerçekten hem cömert hem de başkalarına yardım etmeyi çok seven bir çocuktu. Hayatını her zaman başkalarına yardım etmekle geçirmiş. Açlıklarını hep bu yolda kullanmış. Çok istisnai bir çocuktu.
His character was that he always loved helping people, even at such a young age. He spent his life helping. He used to collect all his pocket money so he can help those who are less advantaged than he is.
Başkalarına yardım etmeyi seven Furkan, Gazze'deki çocukların ambargo altındaki zor durumda olduklarını takip ediyor. Özellikle de yetim çocuklara çok üzülüyordu.
Furkan loved helping, especially helping children, used to follow the events that's going on in Gaza and suffering of the young, especially children, especially those who are orphans in Gaza.
Ve Mavi Marmara'nın Gazze'ye gideceğini öğrendiği zaman ilk başvuranlardan birisidir. Özellikle oradaki çocukların yanında olmak, onlara yapılan haksızlığı biraz da olsa kendisi onların yanında durarak tarafını belli etmek istemişti.
He was one of the first ones to register his name, and he wants to be on board of Mavi Marmara so that he can take part in this and be with those orphans in Gaza, and he wants to be on their side, and he wants to be known to be on their side.
Furkan gemiye çok zor kabul edildi, yaşı küçük olduğu için, ama kabul edildikten sonra oradaki çocuklara valizini hediyelerle doldurmuştu. Onların yanına gitmek, onların yaşadığı şartları teneffüs etmek, onların yanında olduğunu göstermek ve özellikle de dünyaya ablukanın ne kadar hukuksuz olduğunu göstermek istiyordu.
It was very difficult for him to be accepted because he was so young, and it took some convincing to get him accepted to be one of the passengers on Mavi Marmara. But after it was done, he filled his luggages with toys for the kids and what they needed, what the kids needed in Gaza. Because he wanted to be with them, he wanted to live in an environment where how they lived in Gaza, and then wanted to shout out to the world of suffering of these young people that he was so caring for.
Bu yolculuğa çıkarken hiçbir zaman İsrail'in bu şekilde katliam yapacağını ne Furkan ne de biz aklımızın ucundan geçirmedik. Bu nedenle de izin verdik. Gidecekti, dönecekti. Daha sonra üniversite hayatına devam edecekti. Çok güzel planları vardı.
We never thought when they were setting sail for this journey, we never thought Israel would actually do what they did at the time, because we had plans. Furkan was going to go to Gaza, deliver the aid, and then he was going to do his activity and then come back, because we had plans. He was going to go to university, he was going to go to and study medicine. Otherwise, we wouldn't allow such thing. Israel would actually kill these innocent people. We never thought they would do that.
Israel, haksız bir şekilde uluslararası sularda Mavi Marmara'ya saldırdı. Hem Furkan'ımızı hem de onun hayallerini öldürdü.
Unprecedented way, Israel attacked this ship and killed our Furkan and others and took him away from us and killed him.
Birleşmiş Milletler'in insan hakları raporunda açıkça yazdığı üzere ve canlı yayında da izlediğimiz şekilde Furkan'ı bilerek ve kasten İsrail öldürmüştür. İlk ateş açıldığında Furkan yaralanmıştır. Daha sonra İsrail askerleri geminin üst tarafına inerek alnından ve yüzünden 5 kez kasten sıkarak, kurşun sıkarak öldürmüşlerdir. Bunun hesabının sorulması lazım.
It is now established after the event with the reports and United Nations report that Furkan was killed in cold blood by Israeli soldiers on the day. He was shot on initial firing, he was shot and injured. And with the medical reports that we have established that he's been shot 5 times on his forehead and on his face by Israeli soldiers. And we must and must seek justice and be perpetrated to justice.
Biz bu hukuk mücadelemizi Furkan'ın katledilmesinden sonra Amerikan vatandaşı olması sebebiyle başlangıçta Amerika'da dava açılması ya da soruşturma açılması için uzun bir uğraş içindeydik.
After his murder by Israeli, he sought American government's help, insisted in seeking investigation into the killing of Furkan by America because he was an American citizen.
Ancak İsrail'e karşı Amerika'da bu olaydan dolayı herhangi bir dava açamayacağımız, ilgili avukatlar ve görüştüğümüz profesörler, hukuk profesörlerinden öğrendik.
We were told by legal experts and some legal professors at the time, we were seeking advice from them, they were told that we couldn't open up a case in America for Furkan.
Bunun üzerine Amerikan vatandaşı olması nedeniyle ABD Başkanı Obama'ya bir baba olarak mektup yazdım ve kendi evladı olsa ne yapardı diye sorarak Furkan'ın katledilmesiyle ilgili araştırma, soruşturma açılmasını istedim.
Saying, "If it was your child, what would you do? Would you not do anything about it?" So I asked him for help in opening up the investigation and legal pursuing justice for my son.
Yazdığım mektuba Obama'dan gelen cevapta Furkan için soruşturma açamayacaklarını bildirdiler.
President Obama wrote back in a letter to me telling me that there was nothing they could do and they couldn't open up an investigation for Furkan.
Bunun üzerine Amerika'da senatörleri ziyaret ederek, temsilciler meclisindeki üyeleri ziyaret ederek, özellikle Furkan'ın doğduğu eyaletteki senatörleri konuşarak soruşturma açılması isteğimi onlara da ilettim. Ancak herhangi bir sonuç alamadım.
Upon receiving this report from the President, I went and spoke to members of the House of Representatives and Congress in Washington, trying to seek their help in achieving something for my son, but I failed and I've not even been given a reply, especially to the senators of the state where Furkan was born, and I haven't heard nothing.
Sadece şu anda bir dava açabildik. Ehud Bar'a karşı dönemin savunma bakanı olması nedeniyle Furkan'ın katledilmesinden sorumlu olduğunu düşünerek ve Amerika'daki davada karşımızda Ehud Barak yerine İsrail'i ve Amerika Birleşik Devletleri'ni bulduk.
At the moment, we have successfully opened a civil case against Ehud Barak, who was at the time the defense minister of Israel. And whilst we are running this case in United States, we all of a sudden found State of Israel and United States of America opposing us in the civil hearing in the U.S.
Başka bir davada yine diğer arkadaşlarımız anlatacak. İstanbul'da bir davamız var. Ayrıca yerel mahkemede Kayseri'de İsrail'e karşı bir dava açtım. Ancak o İsrail'in yargı bağımsızlığı, bağışıklığı nedeniyle reddedildi. Şu anda İstanbul'daki davamız devam ediyor. 2 Aralık'ta da duruşması var. Bir diğer davada az önce söylendiği gibi Uluslararası Ceza Mahkemesi'nde devam ediyor. Son olarak şunu söylemek istiyorum. Bu mücadelemizi biz sadece Furkan için yapmıyoruz. Aslında insanlık adına bu mücadelenin, hukuk mücadelesinin devam etmesini, eğer adalet varsa mutlaka hesap vermeleri gerektiğini düşünüyorum. Ve bundan sonra da bu şekilde yapılacak katliamları, en azından İsrail tarafından yapılacak katliamların da önüne geçilmiş olabileceğini düşünüyoruz. O yüzden mücadelemize İsrail'in yargılanması açısından devam etmek istiyoruz. Eğer bu dünyada adalet olmazsa terörizm bugün yaşadığımız gibi kendini gösterecektir. O yüzden suç varsa, ki İsrail suçludur, bilerek kasten uluslararası sularda insanları öldürmüştür. Bu kesindir. Bunun da cezalandırılmasını istiyoruz ve bunun mücadelesini veriyoruz. Hukukçuların da bizim yanımızda olmalarını, hukukun üstünlüğünü göstermelerini istiyoruz.
This struggle, the legal struggle that we're launching, isn't just for Furkan, it's for all humankind. This is a case that has implications for all of us. It isn't just about Furkan. So we want to pursue this, we want to continue the struggle, and we will. And we'd love to have international lawyers besides us, in this struggle, because if we let this go and don't pursue justice for a case like this, and we create this zone where there's no legal accountability of such actions, then it will reoccur again. We don't want Israel to be able to do this and get away with. We don't want anyone to get away with such illegal acts of attacking civilians in international waters. This kind of legal void would bring about injustice, and that would create a terrorism. And injustice is something we should not tolerate. And those who are experts in international law, such as international professors of law, should voice their opposition and help and support the causes such as ours, so that people like Furkan, who are killed, and so there's justice is prevailing for them, and that justice is served for these people, just like myself, Furkan. Thank you.
Teşekkür ediyorum. Hayırlı akşamlar.
Thank you very much.
Good evening, everyone. I want to begin with by thanking the organizers of the event. First, a very brief information about Turkish law. Turkey is a civil law country. There is a strict hierarchy among the sources of law, and the constitution sits at the apex of a calcanian pyramid of norms. Basic sources of criminal law, justice are the Penal Code of 2004 and the Criminal Procedure of 2005. Criminal justice system is run by professional judges, not by juries nor lay judges. Procedural agreement on the compensation between Turkey and Israel after the ratification process published in the Official Gazette of Turkey on the 9th of September 2016. And now it's part of Turkish law. International treaties duly put in effect have the same legal value as domestic laws. Yet, the Constitution exempts international treaties from the constitutional review when it states that no appeal to the Constitutional Court shall be made with regard to these agreements. The rationale for this limitation rests on the idea of upholding the principle of pacta sunt servanda. Put in plain terms, the Turkish-Israel agreement is exempt from the constitutional review of otherwise active Turkish constitutional court. Istanbul's 7th High Criminal Court is therefore, as all Turkish courts, under the duty to comply with treaty obligations and the requirements emanating from the present agreement. Article 4 of the agreement contains an amnesty requirement for Israeli citizens in relation to flotilla incident. Relevant part of the article reads, "This agreement will constitute full release from any liability, criminal or civil, in Turkish courts by Turks. An amnesty in Turkish law has the effect of discontinuing the criminal proceedings and setting aside any penalty imposed and its legal consequences. Thus, the Istanbul court shall eventually have to drop the pending case relating to flotilla incident in according to Criminal Procedure Code's Article 223, unless the court considers Article 4 of the agreement as non-self-executing, which would require, so as to directly apply by the courts, further legislative action by the parliaments. The high-ranking Israeli military officials, Ashkenazi, Maron, Yadlin, Levy, are being tried in absentia for inciting the commission of offenses in the Turkish Penal Code. The indictment contains following charges: 10 counts of murder through cruelty and through torment, 114 counts of intentional bodily injury with weapon, which is a qualification of the basic form of bodily injury, 14 counts of intentional bodily injury results with fracture or dislocation of bone, 490 counts of qualified deprivation of liberty, 1 count of prevention of communication, 490 counts of torment, 490 counts of robbery, 1 count of qualified damage to property. Although the Turkish Penal Code sets out international crimes such as the crime of genocide and crimes against humanity, the prosecutors have chosen, for some reason, to accuse defendants for ordinary crimes listed above. The trial began on the 6th of November 2012, and although the court has requested in May 2014 issuance of a red notice for the defendants, the Foreign Affairs Ministry has not passed the notice onto Interpol. The next hearing, adjourned to 2nd of December, next Friday, due to a motion to recuse the presiding judge. It is therefore not foreseeable whether next Friday the court shall dismiss the case. When the court decides to render the judgment on dismissal of the case, the victims shall have the right to appeal against the judgment. Clearly, like dismissal of case is like an acquittal and conviction is a final decision. In case of an unsuccessful appeal, individual applications to the Constitutional Court and the European Court of Human Rights can be considered respectively. Thus being said, this state of affairs begs the question whether the agreement is in conformity with international law at all. One can look for an answer to the Vienna Convention on the Law of Treaties of 1969, yet neither Turkey nor Israel is party to this convention. The treaty, however, would be considered as binding on both states, for then in part very innovative treaty is now considered as part of customary international law. Of the reasons of invalidity of a treaty in the convention, the most relevant for all purposes is the jus cogens requirement. Article 53 of the convention provides that a treaty is void if at the time of its conclusion it conflicts with a norm of general international law. This article was a novelty of the convention rather than its a codification of existing law. France, for instance, resisted against such a provision. There is, however, no sufficient evidence whether in this regard Turkey and Israel can be qualified as persistent objectors. It is frequently asserted that some or all of the crimes under customary international law of genocide, crimes against humanity, of war crimes and aggression enjoy the status of jus cogens. So, assuming therefore that agreement derogates from the peremptory norms of international law, then the next question would be whether parties to the present agreement would ever invoke the procedure of nullity of a treaty under the convention. Indeed, the convention provides that only a treaty whose invalidity is established under the convention is void, which is another, you know, compromise of international law, as it always do. Yeah. Accordingly, before the invalidity procedure is terminated, no party may treat the agreement as a nullity. One may therefore suggest that, in the present case, we are dealing with a legally binding unlawful agreement, which may sound odd in English, but in German or in Turkish perfectly well, because we have Recht, you know, Gesetz, Kanun, Hukuk, you know. It needs to be at this juncture stressed that the invalidation procedure in the convention is solely foreseen for the parties to the treaty, which means that the third parties are not bound by this treaty. Rodney's already mentioned this point. These are significant arguments, since they open new avenues for prosecutions of alleged crimes committed aboard Mavi Marmara by, for example, International Criminal Court or by another domestic court. Indeed, Israeli lawyers who are taking account of such alternative legal avenues that can be utilized by the victims have suggested that, quote, with this Mavi Marmara incident and any other claims of international law violations, the best way to protect Israeli soldiers from prosecution abroad is conducting impartial and effective investigations in Israel. Without such investigations, no international agreement, this agreement as well, can protect soldiers against legal proceedings taking place around the world. Indeed, the present agreement does not shield alleged offenders against criminal proceedings that may be initiated in other countries, including Israel. Rodney again mentioned the procedures in the ICC. But I just want to highlight some points what I think important for discussion. To date, the prosecutor has not yet made her final decision in regard to initiating an investigation. It needs to be stressed that the Turkish-Israeli agreement does not have a bearing upon the prosecutor's decision, at least legally speaking. For the Rome Statute does not contain any rule with regard to national amnesties, and the recognition of amnesties by international tribunals is a still contested, a very contested issue. She may, however, resort to the concept of interest of justice contained in Article 53 of the Statute for not initiating an investigation. Nevertheless, if she decides to choose the notion of the interest of justice, she will need to or have to establish positively why she thinks so. The prosecutors of the ICC, therefore, quite often resort to the gravity test whenever she faces a politically sensible situation. The potential of the ICC should, therefore, not be overestimated, since the court has chosen a path of accommodating itself with the interests of great powers for its own survival. David Bosco, in his meticulously researched study, Rough Justice, has persuasively made the argument that the court, due to political pressure and its yearning for legitimacy, tried hard not to upset great powers. This fact, I think, explained the court's inconsistencies in situations like Palestine, Iraq, and even in the Mavi Marmara. What if, then, the court, the World Criminal Court itself, unable or unwilling to prosecute the gravest crimes that shock humanity as a whole? As a reasonable and relatively convincing explanation for this phenomena can be found in a general disregard and increasing propensity on the part of the great powers to use extra legal force in the post-9/11 world. Remarkably, the ICC was created during an era of optimism, which was akin to post-World War I internationalism, interregnum between the two walls, that of the Berlin Wall and the Twin Towers. There was, during that era, a widespread belief in the cosmopolitan project of the formation of an authentic international law, and the Kant's perpetual peace was off the shelf again. Yet this era of optimism lasted not long, and the pomp and circumstance of international law replaced by an apocalyptic Wagnerian tomb. It is, therefore, no surprise that international criminal law mechanisms perceived by many as mired in power politics, neocolonial, hegemonic, and partial. Thus, I do not see the use of excessive power by the IDF during the Marmara attack as a mere coincidence, but rather as a symbolic act of reaffirmation of the role of hard power in shaping or preserving of already adopted policies. That said, this bleak picture should not bar those who are struggling for justice from their valuable pursuit, since it reaffirms the existence of universal norms and it crystallizes the institution's failures that are designed to protect them. And more importantly, I think, inform the public conscience, which may serve as a cure against the virus of cynicism. Further, campaigns for justice, such as that of Mavi Marmara victims, would like to reduce the propensity of criminals to repeat such heinous acts in the future. One should not underestimate, for instance, the value of public discussions with regard to illegality of Iraq's invasion in 2003, which has been intensified recently as a result of Chicot's report. The states or alleged offenders of the crimes that have been committed in Iraq, in the words of late Lord Bingham, I quote, have not been hauled before the ICJ or any tribunal to answer for their actions, but they have been arraigned at the bar of world opinion and judged unfavorably, with resulting damage to their standing and influence. I believe, ladies and gentlemen, the lasting impact of the Mavi Marmara case will be no different. Thank you for your attention.
So on the 31st of May 2010, the Freedom Flotilla, six ships, three cargo, three passenger, were attacked violently by the Israeli military. And I was aboard the Mavi Marmara ship. My name's Alexandra Lort Phillips, and I was one of 37 British participants in the Freedom Flotilla. We're called activists, but actually we're just ordinary people. And my intention here in this discussion is to just give a little bit of context and remind us of the incident, because it was 6 years ago now. It's hard to remember the impact it had in the public eye and also the nature of the incident itself. Just before I go on to the slides, I just wanted to make the point, and it's been echoed here, that amongst the many powers which states have, authorizing military action must be one of the most important and severe powers which they use and abuse. This is an authorization to death and destruction, and this is why it's a grave responsibility and so important that we have the strongest regulation and the most accountability for the operation of military operations. If states and their actors cannot take responsibility and be accountable for their actions in this most important domain, then how could they be trusted in other domains of government and responsibility for people? So when people see failures in states to take responsibility for their people and others across the world, then ordinary people like us have to do something about it. And it's not with joy that we do it. Direct action is the last resort. So I hope you listen to all the discussions, all the presentations today, and find this an interesting topic, because it could be a vital topic that needs to be researched in future. We've seen the fragmentation of the political scene in the last 12 to 15 years, and I think that the undermining of universal jurisdiction is yet another example of why people may choose to opt for other sources of authority. So, if I go back to why I personally became involved in this, I can remember sitting with my family in Christmas 2008, and these images that you can see on the left of Gaza being bombed, the UN school at the top there being destroyed. And I jumped up from my seat. I was shocked. I went to a demonstration in London, which you can see there, with thousands of other people, and I resolved to try and find out a bit more about what was happening here. So when I looked further into it, I found out that the Gaza Strip is an area which is roughly the size of Bristol and Edinburgh cities combined and has 750,000 more people residing there than those two cities combined. It's also 50% of the population is under the age of 18. So while it's been occupied by the Israeli state next door since 1967, it was only since 2006 that this particular territory was considered to be hostile territory by the state of Israel, and as such subjected to restrictions, which have been in various forms since that time. So the hostile territory label has been given to the entire population. I'm just going to play this first 2 minutes of this clip from the Medical Aid for Palestinians charity, because it features John Ging, who at the time, this was made 6-7 years ago, gives his opinion about the situation in Gaza. And this situation is what motivated people like me to take part in convoys and flotillas. I hope there's audio.
يعني اليوم احنا زي ما انت شايف في الصقيع وفي الشتاء وفي الرياح، احنا ما بنستنى اليوم، ما بنستنى كابول ولا بنستنى مواد غذائية، احنا بنستنى منهم مأوى.
Gaza is on the brink of becoming the first territory in the world to be intentionally reduced to a state of abject destitution. This is not an accident or the result of a natural disaster. It is a matter of policy. Israel's blockade seals off the territory by land, air and sea, imprisoning 1.5 million people. The blockade means the delay or denial of fuel, commercial goods, and even as Gaza becomes more dependent, humanitarian aid.
The siege on Gaza has been in place now for over 2.5 years. Essentially, the siege restricts all items coming into Gaza. The situation at the moment is unbearable. Physically, the place is a complete mess in terms of the infrastructure. There's no economy. 80% of the population are depending on handouts of food. The medical facilities are under massive strain. The water and sanitation situation is deplorable, and so on. Very devastating on their mindsets and their mentality.
So that video goes on for another 7 minutes. So I won't continue with that, but you're welcome to look at all these links on the presentation link when it's shared. Basically, when ordinary people like me see this going on and they see the failure of political leaders, they look at ways to respond. And one of the ways that people responded in 2009-10 was by organising road convoys and trying to break the blockade by sea. So these are very diverse groups of people, all different backgrounds, religions, ages, political persuasions. I think in my team we had a Tory voter and a communist. It was very diverse. But the common language was transnational and international law and justice under international legal principles. That's where we were seeking our authority and asking them to respect the Geneva Conventions and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights to give everybody equal opportunity. So the Free Gaza Movement is an organization that has successfully sailed for Gaza port 5 times by the time we decided to organize this flotilla. And we've all felt that the best way to keep everybody safe in this larger flotilla was to be as open as possible, to have VIPs on board, to have as much media as we could on board, rigged up the boat with CCTV so that everything was as open as possible and all of the goods and people were checked by the Turkish authorities in Istanbul. Obviously, the British participants wanted to take part, and they raised the money to buy enough goods to fill up this lorry, which we took to Istanbul and loaded onto the ships in the port. And we found this huge operation going on. You can see there were large generators in the middle there for hospitals and schools, because power cuts are very common in the Gaza Strip. And down to the small items, the little presents from school children in the UK just to school children in Gaza, very simple. Toothbrushes, underwear, just a solidarity gift to solidarity. And we met with friends who we'd met before. And so the feeling was very optimistic. We thought, okay, well, the boats have got through before. We've been as open as possible. We have nothing with us apart from items that I've already described. We have a good chance. And then this is what happened. And I'm just going to play you the clip.
Israeli forces stormed at least one ship attempting to break the blockade of Gaza. Rebels lowered themselves from the helicopters and onto the Mavi Marmara. That's the lead ship in a flotilla of 6 vessels which are carrying aid for the Palestinian territory. We can confirm that at least 2 people have been killed and more than 30 have been injured. Israeli radio is reporting the death toll, maybe as high as 16 people. While a reporter on board the ship signed this report before communications were cut.
The organizers on board the Mavi Marmara, after 2 people have been confirmed killed by the Israeli army, have now asked all the passengers to go inside. They've raised the white flag, and this after Israeli commandos descended upon the ship in international water from a helicopter, as well as surrounded it by vessels from all sides. Tens of people, civilians, have been injured. There are still sounds of life fire despite the white flag being raised. Tens of people have been injured. 2 people have been killed on board the ship, which holds 600 activists, parliamentarians, women, children, and the elderly, all of whom are civilians. Organizers have asked everyone to go inside. So this is where we shall head. Jamal Al-Shayal, Al Jazeera, on board the Mavi Marmara in the international waters of the Mediterranean Sea.
So it might give you a little sense there of what the atmosphere was like on board the vessel. I don't think I have time to play the other film or any part of it. It's a graphic, disturbing clip. It'll be available on the slides. And those who are interested can see what it was actually like on that vessel. This is one of the few bits of footage that was able to make it out, because the filmmaker, Yara Lee, who operates in many human rights situations across the world, had provided her cameraman with a small memory chip and was able to take the footage out. So it wasn't 2 who died, it was 10. At least 50 injured. All the property that we had was taken. All our media, all the phones, computers, all the evidence was confiscated by the Israeli authorities. We were forcibly removed to Israel and to prison. After a couple of days, we finally got access to our consulate, and we finally were told that the Turkish government had arranged safe passage for us to Istanbul. And that is when we found out the scale of the response to this incident. The United Nations Security Council had called an emergency meeting and commissioned the Human Rights Council, asked the Human Rights Council to commission an investigation, and you can see the link there for the fact-finding report. Israel refused to participate or return any evidence or accept the report, producing their own. So there were further reports, and as I said to my colleagues, I couldn't actually bring myself to put the link to the final report in this presentation because I found it to be so flawed. We are still seeking legal remedies. And it was a very confusing thing for our professionals and our colleagues to actually work out which routes to take. The important thing about it, has already been mentioned, is what happens if we do not pursue justice? Since that incident, there have been two further wars in Gaza, and the last main incursion, the Operation Protective Edge, more than 2,400 people were killed. That is more than Operation Cast Lead. And let's remember, these operations, the Cast Lead is talking about casually throwing heavy metal onto a heavily populated strip of land. We can't stand up for this. We can't stand for this. We have to stand up against it. So not only is the state of Israel emboldened, possibly, this is a question that I would ask you as researchers to look at. How is it that since 2008-09, two more wars have occurred there and more people have been killed and we just seem to be frozen? The world seems to be frozen in response. And how about the other atrocities that are happening in this region and other places across the world? I mean, perhaps we need to look back to 2003, the invasion of Iraq, to find out when people started crumbling their faith in the achievement of true justice through international law. So I leave you with questions. And I haven't returned to this, but if you are interested, I did write a diary at the time, which is online, and it gives many more details about the convoys and the flotillas at that time. Thank you.
Lovely. Well, thank you very much. My name is John Childcraft. I'm an associate professor in the government department. And I'd like to thank very much the government department and the Center for the Study of Human Rights for sponsoring this event, and to the Middle East Center and the Institute of Global Affairs for publicizing it, and to very much to all the panelists for coming, and to you, the audience. It's exciting for me. I'm an academic in the government department at LSE. I set this event up partly in the hope and out of a logic of putting researchers together with civil society, actors, activists, lawyers, human rights workers, in order to enrich the research that's being done in the university and the sorts of questions that students ask, and in order to make that research more relevant. And it's a learning process, very interesting. And you realize the sorts of responsibilities you have if you're supposedly representing phenomena as an academic, and you find yourself encountering, you know, very serious, ongoing questions, in this case, of law. I'm only here to make two points, actually. And the first is based on the fact that I was commissioned to submit an independent expert report to the California District Court in the case brought on behalf of Furkan Dogan against Ehud Barak, the then Minister of Defense. And so, you know, if we remember the young Furkan Dogan, he's the Turkish-American, the son of Ahmed over here. He's just out of high school, and he's the one who was shot while standing on the upper deck of the Mavi Marmara while he was filming. And then he fell to the floor and he was shot again, and he was shot a number of times. So this report that I wrote concluded that it was entirely false, misplaced, and prejudicial to apply the doctrine of political immunity to dismiss the adjudication. I said that was a false and misleading application that stemmed from a basic misunderstanding of what was at stake in the case and a misunderstanding of the structure of governance in the United States.
At stake in the case, as we've already heard, is a claim of civil liability by a US citizen in the matter of an alleged unlawful killing by a foreign official on the high seas. What's not always so clearly understood and needs to be explained as clearly as possible is that the structure of governance in the United States, as generated by treaties, by statutory law, by case law precedent, by human rights legislation, mandates a particular place for the adjudication of such civil liability claims as a purely legal matter, with absolutely without impact or prejudice to questions of policy or questions of interstate relations. And I'm not going to go through all the detail, but Rodney Dixon QC already mentioned the Torture Victim Protection Act. That was signed into law in 1992 by President Bush Sr. And the official long title of that act makes its purpose very clear. It is, and I quote, an act to carry out the obligations of the United States under the United Nations Charter and other international agreements pertaining to the protection of human rights by establishing a civil action for recovery of damages from an individual who engages in torture or extrajudicial killing, unquote. The statute allows for the filing of civil suits in the United States against individuals who, acting in an official capacity for any foreign nation, commit torture or extrajudicial killing. And this mandated place in the structure of governance is designed to allow the law to have a role in the case of breaches of the very most basic and agreed on universal human rights. And the core of those, academics usually agree on this, are the rights to the person. So they're the right to life. And that includes, and I'm quoting from a major study, that includes the right to be, quote, free from extrajudicial execution and disappearance, and the freedom from torture and arbitrary arrest and detention, unquote. So the way that mandate, that this channel that's established in the U.S. structure of governance is precisely designed to allow adjudication to proceed in such a case, irrespective of and without confounding or interfering with questions of policy or questions of interstate relations. So in this civil liability case between Furkan Dugan, or the relatives of Furkan Dugan, and Ehud Barak, Minister of Defense, no question of policy or of interstate relations is before the court. So in particular, the case does not raise the issue of the legality of the naval blockade of Gaza. It doesn't raise any policy or foreign policy question. So it's a civil liability claim around the alleged unlawful killing of a US citizen on the high seas. So this report concluded that the smokescreen of political immunity in this case turns out to be just that. It's irrelevant to the legal process at stake. That's my first point. The second point is more epistemic rather than legal. It stems more from my training as a historian and someone who's studied social movements in the Middle East and North Africa, and I'm just starting up a research project on transnational solidarity. It's based on my research on that, and also some first-hand knowledge of the Gaza Freedom Flotilla and some research on it. And this is simply, I mean, it's a very simple point, but it's that it's a profound misrepresentation of the truth to argue, as many who've attempting to dismiss these cases have done, that the humanitarians aboard the Gaza Freedom Flotilla were in fact terrorists. And we've heard extensively from those who think they're defending the Israeli state that people on the Freedom Flotilla were seeking martyrdom, that they were conspiring with Hamas, that they had firearms, that they used firearms, this is a fabrication worthy of the worst claims of governments in recent times, they were actually, they were linked to Al-Qaeda. This is a tissue of shameless lies and baseless distortions and fabrications. In fact, the Freedom Flotilla aimed to deliver humanitarian supplies to suffering civilians by peaceful means to alleviate and to raise awareness about their suffering. The humanitarian goals of the protagonists are clearly stated on many occasions, extensively detailed, as in the run-up to the mission, after the mission, during the mission, even on first contact with the Israeli armed forces, as the various commissions that looked into it and studied it afterwards made clear. They announced to the Israelis, we are a humanitarian mission, and so on. They carried 10,000 tons of humanitarian aid, and that ranging from medical equipment to toys for children. The humanitarian suffering they're talking about, of course, has been extensively documented. One place to look for that is the UN Human Rights Council report. And even the BBC reported on it in 2010 when they said among the everyday items forbidden by the Israelis include, quote, jam, chocolate, wood for furniture, fruit juice, textiles, and plastic toys, unquote. Passengers on the flotilla were civilians from 40 different countries, including artists, academics, doctors, and there were parliamentarians from Egypt, Sweden, Germany, and even Israel itself. And among those who were killed by the Israeli commandos, in addition to the recent high school graduate, Furkan Durgan, were a professional sports coach, a telephone repair shop owner, and others. No firearms were discharged by any of the passengers, and they didn't have any firearms in the first place. Even the Israeli chief of staff, Gabi Ashkenazi, testified that he did not believe that the Turkish IAH, one of the organizers of the flotilla, was a terrorist organization. Anyway, so as an academic, I wanted to advance this very basic point that it's a profound epistemic violence to represent the flotilla as terrorism. It's a willful and cynical distortion that should have no place in our picture of the case. So, to conclude, I simply wanted to explain that it's false and misplaced to apply the doctrine of political immunity to the case of Durgan versus Barak. It's a prejudicial move based on a basic misunderstanding of what's at stake and a misunderstanding of the structure of governance in the United States. And indeed, we must guard against the significant danger of the outsized and prejudicial application of political immunity to exclude adjudication on cases where fundamental human rights are in play. That misapplication ultimately amounts to a usurpation of the rule of law. Secondly, the Freedom Flotilla were not terrorists, they were humanitarians. To suggest otherwise is a willful politicizing distortion. And on a larger level, we can't allow false accusations of terrorism to scare us into silence on questions of law, accurate representation, and fundamental human rights. And to me, a striking symbol of what's at stake here comes in the contrast between the young, enthusiastic Furkan Durgan, who's filming on the upper deck. That's what he's doing up there. He's filming what's going on. He's trying to record the truth of this encounter to the outside world, and then he's violently killed in an effort to silence and to destroy that film. Well, I'm by no means convinced that his testimony has in fact been in vain. I believe the truth can come out as long as there are people around to push for it. And so for this reason, I salute the families and the lawyers and the human rights workers and the ordinary people who refuse to be bowed by real politic, who refuse to be bought off, and who continue to press for accountability and justice. And I wish you every success.
Well, thank you very much. A terrific panel. Really lovely, varied discussion of the issues. And now it's your turn to say something. So we've got a bit of time for... We prefer questions. We prefer short questions. But if you do have comments, that's fine, too. So what I think I'll do is I'll bundle two or three questions together, and then you can take them in that order. So we have a question down the front and a question over there. So let's start over here first.
Good Good evening, and let me first apologize for my voice if it's not clear. My question is, I understand that there were 32 British citizens on board the Marmara, that they were directly affected in the attack, yet no response was given by British government. And I was wondering, should we expect the possibility of bringing an action in the United Kingdom?
Great, thank you. Okay, so there's a question out on the left, and then a question at the back, and we'll just stop with those three for the time being.
Thank you very much. I don't want to sound too cynical, but my question is universal jurisdiction very seriously damaged anyway on the reality that it cannot be applied against prominent citizens of certain countries, I would think particularly Russia and China, in any country, because applying it against them would lead to serious reprisals against companies and individuals of the state which seeks to take that action. And I do realize that there are Chinese citizens on the road. In relation to the actions against Edward Barak, I sadly suggest your best bet might be to arrange protests in front of press cameras when the Hollywood film comes out in about a year's time, in which he appears as a prominent character. And I will offer a large donation to the NAP charity if anybody wishes to speak to me afterwards. There is a condition attached to that, to get a letter signed by a senior UK representative of a foreign government denying allegations that an official of that government was involved in aiding and abetting the murder of 8 British citizens, including children. Thank you.
Okay, one final question up the back there.
Yeah, I have a question for the last speaker. How do you define state power? In the context of that definition, would you consider Israel as a terrorist state regarding this incident?
Okay, who wants to have a go at those questions? John, you don't want to take the last one first, do you?
I could do. This is obviously a long debate. I mean, my favourite article in the academic world on terrorism and terrorists is by Charles Tilley. It's published somewhere like Sociological Forum in 2003. And he distinguishes terror as a tactic. It's something that's used for a political aim, the killing of civilians for a political aim, usually directed to terrorize or to intimidate. But the interesting point is that it's a tactic that's used by a wide variety of different groups, non-state actors, state actors, and that's been the case since the term was coined in the 1790s when it referred to the Jacobin terror, so it was a state-based tactic. But the question of, therefore, is there such an actor as a terrorist, meaning somebody who's so devoted to this tactic that defines, explains, and describes their action, whether they're a state or a non-state actor, well, that's another question. That's quite difficult to find, somebody who behaves like that. And so to apply it to a whole state is to make that claim, and it's overreaching. It's almost always used to say it's violence we disapprove of.
Great. Anyone?
I'll add a few things. First of all, in relation to UK citizens, the possibilities of bringing civil claims are quite complicated here because the acts took place abroad, and that creates difficulties in terms of looking at jurisdiction here for essentially personal injury type claims against the government. The government also potentially has immunity, although you could proceed against the individuals concerned. That's something that is still being looked at, but the main focus at the moment is on the criminal investigation, because the police here certainly have jurisdiction under universal laws to investigate and to arrest anyone who travels here. They will only do that if somebody travels here, and of course you have to get the authority of the Director of Public Prosecution. So there is a political element in it to that extent, because that person also has to consult with the Attorney General. But that's the main focus, looking at criminal investigations. In respect of universal jurisdiction, that's the point that is always made against it. And it's certainly what we've seen in the US. That's what the State Department says. They say, well, you know, if we allow this, won't it mean that when our officials go abroad, they get prosecuted as well? Or won't it open up serious problems with other superpowers? And as a result of that, they will then seek to block anything, potentially even against states that they're not that friendly with. Although there have been a few that have slipped through the net, because you know, if it's a country somewhere where they're not that concerned, they might allow it to go ahead. But the simple answer to that is that, you know, as John was saying, if these cases are based on proper investigation and facts, if they're not political, then they should be entitled to go ahead. And they go ahead within the constraints of the legal system in the US. And if there are serious problems with other countries and extraditing people there, well, then there are always protections in respect of fair trials or political exceptions which can be used. So it doesn't undermine the system to allow proper investigated cases to go ahead where there's sufficient evidence and where it can be done legally. Just last in respect of terrorism, interestingly, in the Washington case that has been brought against the State of Israel, we are also proceeding under the Anti-Terrorism Act on the basis that in the US terrorism is defined in a certain way as targeting civilians, and the allegation is that these facts fit within the definition under US law. So forget the rhetoric of terrorism and pointing fingers. It's looking at it from a purely legal point of view. This is the definition. These acts fit within that act. And states don't have immunity under this act if you can come within the ambit of that act. So that's one of the legal bases we're trying in the Washington case against the State of Israel itself.
Okay, let's take some more questions. Gentleman down the front here.
Thanks. This is not a legal question. Alexandra mentioned that there were five successful trips by boat into Gaza. I was on the fourth one, which was a little cabin cruiser called the Dignity, which went from Cyprus to Gaza. And I went with another LSE colleague, Mike Cushman, as academics, because we wanted to bring out some students who were trapped there and couldn't get out to their universities around the world. The point I want to make is that although the sixth trip was intercepted by and the Dignity was rammed by an Israeli destroyer, that was during the actual Qassam-led invasion. All the other five went uninterrupted. So the question I want to raise is, you know, why it happened to the Mavi Marmara. Now, what we did was very much the same as the Mavi Marmara. We published a list of everybody who was on the boat. It was on the website. All the medical supplies. There was a doctor who was going there to carry out operations. There was an Al Jazeera team going in to take some films. And although we were approached by an Israeli warship, it stayed at some distance off, and some of them, they came closer and hailed, but they were allowed through. So why was the Mavi Marmara not allowed? And I think it must, my speculation, but I'd be interested in other people's views, was that this was because if they let that one through, their blockade was finished. And I would suggest that the extreme violence, or the considerable violence that was used, was deliberate. The killings were not accidental. They wanted to make it clear that to anyone who might be inclined to join such a venture, that they would be at risk of their lives, and therefore they would not go.
Mm-hmm. Yes, question down here.
Okay. I'd like to ask, Alessandra said, she asked, what happens if we don't pursue justice? And I'd like to ask, first, what kind of justice can we realistically expect? Because isn't peace a good trade-off for justice? And also, isn't this a problem of transnational justice? And also, what's kind of the fairness of these trade-offs in the peace-building process? Because can we really try to achieve justice? But isn't it more important to guarantee peace and achieve peace to avoid more suffering? Thank you.
I was just going to mention what was said by Rodney, actually, which was to do with the peace and reconciliation process in South Africa was at the inclusion, included the victims in that process, and therefore it was able to be peaceful. If you have an authority, which the Israeli state is characterizing, which dictates when things are peaceful. I mean, when they said that they withdrew from the Gaza Strip, they said we've withdrawn now. There's no, you know, now everything's fine. It's not. It wasn't fine at all. The people living in Gaza continue to live under occupation and subsequently siege and blockade. So, I'll let someone else make that point. But we haven't been included in this process. So where will the peace come from? You know, when will we, as victims and the people we stand in solidarity with, actually feel like they want to put this argument down?
Can I just strike an optimistic note on the question of universal jurisdiction, which is to say that throughout the history of international law and universal jurisdiction, people have expressed grave doubts and a certain degree of cynicism about universal jurisdiction. And I don't say that all of that cynicism is misplaced, but every so often somebody goes to the wrong place and finds themselves subject to an arrest warrant, as occurred to Senator Pinochet when he visited Margaret Thatcher and had tea with her in 1998. The Bow Street magistrate found himself signing an arrest warrant for Mr. Pinochet amongst the Smiths and the Turners and so on. So that was a sort of one of these, I call it the law of unintended consequences. No one really could have predicted when the Torture Convention came into being and universal jurisdiction was enlivened under that convention that somebody like Pinochet would end up in the wrong place at the wrong time. Or, for that matter, that Adolf Eichmann would be brought to Israel from Buenos Aires and stand trial under principles of universal jurisdiction for crimes committed in Germany between 1939 and 1945. Perhaps a strange example in this context. But nevertheless, it is worth remembering that when you enact a law, it's very rare for someone to be so far-sighted that they can work out every possible consequence of the enactment of that law. Yeah.
I was a bit troubled by the panel. And we had the flotillas, and one of the reasons there were the flotillas is because I think many of the people on them and activists realized that international law is not going to solve the problem. And they understood that direct actions from citizens around the world have to go and break the siege. And then we have this panel, and the panel is discussing whether international law can be our savior. And I don't think it's a panel of believers, or most of the panel is a panel of believers, and I, for one, am not a believer. And I think we have to broaden the context and look that the African countries are leaving the ICC. They are leaving the ICC because they understand something very important. And I think that the way the law is relating to the victims on the Navi Mama has to do also with the color of the victims and the fact that they're Muslims. And international law is problematic. And I think that one of the things we need to think about is what do we do when international law fails us and not constantly go back at how to make international law work?
That was all.
That's a good point.
I wanted to pick up on something that was said here. Yeah, I think it's...
And Pinochet was with this.
Yes.
We have to remember.
Yes.
Okay, so to bring back Pinochet is not correct. Pinochet was released, and actually, if we look at the ICC and what the ICC has done in terms of what universal jurisdiction has managed to do, even from 2002, it's not very much.
No, there's been one prosecution here in the UK and the universal jurisdiction of an Afghan warlord, which arguably suited the interests of those who were in power at the time. And all the efforts that have been made from many sources, there have been lots of cases litigated on this, haven't been able to succeed yet. But the point I was wanting to make was that there have been small breakthroughs, and without contesting in this area and trying to develop the law, nothing will ever happen. It will then just be a complete open goal for people to travel around the world and do whatever they want. And even though people aren't always arrested, the fact that these things are going on means that people are careful, very careful often, about traveling. And they, between states, are very often concerned about what will happen. And that can, therefore, impact upon the ways in which states deal with each other, what their relations are. And also can make those who are accused feel very isolated and imprisoned in their own areas, and certainly very agitated as well. This kind of law is not an area that people warm to when they've got concerns about whether they've been involved in war crimes, crimes against humanity, genocide. And that has a deterrent effect on them and others, and potentially does affect the ways in which states are going to relate, who they're going to invite. We saw this in relation to what happened in South Africa with Bashir traveling there. We've seen it in other situations as well. Yes, people often don't observe the law, but it doesn't mean that they aren't concerned about it and it's not having an effect. And without doing anything, there would be no constraint. And we know what happens when humans have no constraints at all, even in national society, it can easily deteriorate. So it's so important that we do keep that line and try and advance it. And eventually, through taking these steps, I do believe that the law will be implemented more and more and more. I mean, who would have ever guessed after the former Yugoslavia and the conflict there, or Rwanda, that you'd have courts set up? Yes, arguably they weren't directly within the interests of the Security Council members, but nevertheless they were set up. People who had been in power were tried. In Sierra Leone, you saw the same with Charles Taylor. As these begin to happen, it becomes more difficult for others to justify why they should be left out. What's happening with the ICC is also beginning to embarrass a lot of countries, because they're saying, well, the problem with this is that only certain countries are targeted. And that process does have an effect. I do believe governments, politicians, armed forces, they get embarrassed by double standards. But unless you're creating them, they'll feel they can do whatever they want.
I could see something.
Yeah.
You remind me of something Cicero said, which was that the more law, the less justice. but that's too simple. I mean, I agree with you. If you want to say we have to make distinctions between the law, which is a binding set of codes that's already in existence, and, say, norms, which are collective expectations as to how an actor should behave, and they're not binding. And so we have to have a normative dimension as well as a legal dimension. But there's a historic point that has to be made here. I mean, I agree with what was said earlier about how there was a kind of a high, you know, in some respects, I mean, I've been reading some of the literature around this. You get this book, it's called Activists Across Borders by Keck and Sicking, published in 1998. It's sort of quite optimistic about the possibility of establishing human rights norms in the law. And you think, well, where are we now? Post 9/11, now post Trump. There is actually maybe more of a reason now to with these kind of, this sort of liberal internationalism, it's no longer the thing that's being used to justify intervention, military attacks around the world. It's the thing that's under threat from nationalist and xenophobic forces. So I think there's more of a reason for critical and sorts of progressive work to think about what, you know, there's more of a reason to think, well, maybe there's more to the defense of universal forms of law and norms than there might have been in an epoch where there was a lot of liberal triumphalism. It may be that we've moved out of the epoch of liberal triumphalism now. I mean, the other thing is, and so it's worth thinking about. I mean, but it's a complex question, isn't it? I mean, I don't think we can make a dichotomy, though, certainly between justice and the law, because there's really people who are seeking justice, and they're going to see what's there in legal terms. And my point was a purely legal one, that there is a place for the civil liability claim in the US. It's there. Whether even regardless of our normative position on it, it's there. And so, as a legal matter, and so people who seek justice, they can try and use it. And the other point was also very simple, which is an epistemic one, about because the image, the distortion of the image of the Ravi Marma as the derogation from the image as humanitarian is used for political purposes, and we can push back against that, you know, regardless of what we think about the bigger question. So, but I mean, you know, I agree. I mean, your provocation's vitally important. There's no basis for being starry-eyed about it, and I think it requires people to be pushing for it, else it doesn't exist.
Yeah, we needed your provocations. You know, it's funny. A good thing to remember about international law, I think, is that it's compared to English law, we're in a period around sort of 1530 and 1540. I mean, it's an extremely primitive system, and it's rather important. I do agree not to invest too much faith in it, because it can be a law of disappointment. People who expect a great deal from the law are not infrequently terribly disappointed, because they encounter all sorts of jurisdictional, procedural, realpolitik obstacles. So that's a very common sort of narrative. Someone comes to the law expecting a huge amount of justice and then is disappointed that it seems very, very technical and procedural. But on the other hand, just to go back to your Pinochet point, I'm not sure that the point of a legal system is to put people in jail all the time. I mean, legal trials do a lot of different sorts of work, and the Pinochet case had enormous expressivist impact in the world, whatever happened to Pinochet. And I like to think he returned to Chile a broken man and a more or less convicted torturer and so on and so forth. So it couldn't have been a very comfortable existence. And of course, he found himself mired in legal proceedings back in Chile. So it does work, as the song goes, in mysterious ways, the legal system. And we should take some solace from that.
Yeah. Hello. Good evening. I don't know, I've just been a little bit moved by the comment of the colleague there, and I'm one of those people who started the Free Gaza movement when we started sending boats to Gaza, and that was simply a civil action. I don't like the terms activist. I think we're all in it together. But we do need to provide the material for you guys who work in the law to kind of find an exit strategy. I was also moved by John's comment about terrorism, and I think there is a moral right to terrorism sometime when the government and the system goes against everything that makes sense, and you feel you move as a citizen, as a civilian, to do your duty towards injustices somewhere else, and you're crushed by the system. The government policies are against you. The justice doesn't know anything about you. The international system basically doesn't exist for you. It does exist for the big fat pockets and, you know, city boys and bankers and insurance companies and all that things. And then what is your options as a citizen? And I was really disturbed when I was confronted by I've been doing things since I was young in Palestine, because I am from Palestine. I was shot 6 times, arrested 28 times, whatever. And on the ship, I had a fair treatment as well. However, he just looked me in the eye and he was screaming and he was like, my friend from Birmingham, he was talking to the Prime Minister last month directly and the Prime Minister was responding to him and he'd never been to politics. He just had to go to Syria and carry a gun. And you've been doing 20 years of activism and look at you. You still believe in this system and justice and this. And he just drove off that room and I didn't exactly know what to say. And does it really take this kind of whining jaya of injustice, us, into having to disbelieve in the system that exists against us? And do we really need to kind of have a panel to discuss the possibility of having justice in a system which is unjust? And where are we going? Where's our options? Or do we really, as a citizens, have a moral obligation towards creating an exit strategy where we need to kind of like hold law accountable and maybe push for a different body which should be governed by not the G8 countries or, you know, political powerful people like Trump? I don't know.
Okay, thanks.
It's not a question.
So maybe I think we might make this the final question of the panel, unless anyone's burning to ask another one. Let's see how it goes.
Yeah. Thank you all guys for coming and a fantastic talk. I'd like to pay special respect to our fallen son. My main question is, well, it's a couple of points. One is that in the same way that the Magna Carta came to happen, in which it first of all made those at the highest level accountable by law, is where we can move forward. Second point, which is what you said about the ICC and Omar Bashir, about being careful in when he travels, I think it's actually made the quite opposite situation in which a lot of countries are now leaving the ICC because of that same point. There's no point having the sparrows caught but the eagles are free to do whatever. And in my case, is the case of Bush and Blair not being accountable for what they've done on the Iraqi invasion. So aren't we really missing the main point, which is not to bring the Israel and other minor states to law, but actually bringing our own accountable to law by making our own prime ministers and presidents accountable to the highest court of the ICC? Then, and only then, can we make a serious international law, because there's no point of having a court without an enforcer. And unless we enforce this on our leaders, I think it's futile.
Okay, so let's take a final question over here on the right.
I actually have the mic.
Yes. Two questions on the right then.
Hi, my name is Nathan. I'm a third year law student here. I have a question for the three lawyers on the panel who I can't unfortunately see behind this, but it's to do with the question of universal jurisdiction. So the leading case on the matter at the ICJ was the arrest warrant case. And I can't remember the name of the judge, but it was a French judge on the panel. And he wrote in very strong words that he didn't believe that it should exist because it would lead to total judicial chaos. And I think what he was trying to get at was effectively universal jurisdiction would be used as a political tool by nation states. So I was wondering if you two had any beliefs in that there's a merit against universal jurisdiction in his claims.
We'll take this question first and then we'll
While listening, I couldn't stop remembering the Kosovo intervention. And I mean, I know it's a naive question to ask, but could this exception be an example for possible future humanitarian intervention to Israel? Because, I mean, the situation looks all the same. I mean, yeah, thank you.
Okay, well, I'm happy to have a go at two of those. But the ones on the right. Well, on humanitarian intervention, no comment on that, really. I will say this, though, that the Kosovo intervention was a rather strange catalogue of legal events. So there were Security Council resolutions, of course, condemning Serbian actions in Kosovo as a threat to the peace. So at least two significant Security Council resolutions that accompanied the very sort of powerful humanitarian arguments put by the Western powers. So it does strike me, and the argument has been made by the United States, that this was a wholly exceptional circumstance and they didn't want a repeat of it, for the usual reasons that we worry about humanitarian interveners. And after all, humanitarian intervention is a form of war. And we have to take seriously decisions to go to war against anybody. On your question, good question on the arrest warrant case. I think that concern is probably a bit misplaced. I don't know how many courts, how many states are really that keen to engage with the issue of universal jurisdiction. My view is that international law is indifferent to universal jurisdiction, and that came through quite strongly in the separate opinions in the arrest warrant case, if you remember, the Higgins, Coyman's, Bergenthal decisions. Now I'm really sounding like a lawyer. But if you look at those decisions, I think you get a more nuanced reading of what universal jurisdiction might be. And you must remember, too, of course, and you probably know this, that case was decided on questions of immunity, which are not irrelevant here either, rather than on questions of jurisdiction. But yeah, good question.
I mean, in relation to that point, I mean, I think some of the dissenting opinions, or the separate opinions, including the one of Christine van Vengort as well, should be taken into account, where they were saying precisely the opposite, that it's not a question of throwing the justices upside down. It's rather looking at trying to regulate how it would be possible to ensure that US Cogens norms are properly investigated and prosecuted to end impunity. So the whole point is not to create chaos, it's to try and create some order. And it can be done if there's a proper lawful basis for doing it. You have to have proper evidence. This can't be used for political reasons. It's got to be based on the facts as they are disclosed by the evidence. And then it has to be based on the legal system being able to judge fairly the persons who come before it. So there have to be fair trials. And if you're doing it just for political reasons, of course it's going to be chaotic. But the whole point is to try and introduce some regulation into this. And it will take time, and it's not going to be straightforward. The point was made, I mean, it took, how did our national courts look like 1,000 years ago? I mean, no one would have thought we'd ever be here today. They would have thought, oh, gosh, this is never going to work. The nobility is going to rule this forever. And over hundreds of years of sustained change and work, we've got to this point. We've still got a long way to go, and some people want to take it in the other direction. So we have to be careful. But the point I'm trying to make is that you've got to enter into it with good faith, genuineness, and try and regulate it in a way that avoids chaos. To simply say, okay, well, this is going to bring the whole system down, is to completely admit defeat and to ignore, frankly, the problem that's there, which is that the more impunity you allow and, in fact, turn a blind eye to, the less chance you're going to have, to come back to the question earlier, of true peaceful settlements getting into place and then remaining thereafter. I mean, so that's the challenge. You've got to take it head on. And then just lastly, in relation to Bashir, I think my point is a bit misunderstood. I was using that as an example of how generally leaders have to be careful if there is an indictment out there. I agree with the criticism that if you just focus on a few, it's not going to advance the system. And that's what's coming at the moment. Without looking at it being truly universal, it will have serious deficiencies for the future. So it's not a question of destroying the court and let's just remove it. It's got to change. It's got to reform. But we've got to use that as a basis and make it one that treats all states on an equal basis.
Ali. The universal jurisdiction question. It's been debated, you know. Just imagine the cases like Belgium where the universal jurisdiction utterly failed due to political pressure, or the German cases against Rumsfeld. Germans have in their criminal court, actually they have a special criminal court for international crimes, a universal jurisdiction, but again, there are certain limitations. There are ambitious texts like Princeton Principles, very ambitious. I salute that. I think two questions emerges. One, what type of criminality should be under universal jurisdiction? Two, do we need a really liberal universal jurisdiction, or limitation such as the presence of the accused or suspected in the respective country. Yeah, in the case of Pinochet, we had this condition. You know, he was in the wrong place. With respect to the question regarding the humanitarian interventions, now in international law, responsibility to protect as a notion carries the day. You know, this is still also debated. Where does the responsibility to protect fails and the rights of other states intervene on behalf of the people oppressed? These are the notions are really debated. A general remark, I'm not really idealistic realist, which may sound paradoxical. Preserving the ideas but not keeping sight of reality, what we have as a fact, I have certain misgivings with regard to the existing structure of international system or president says that every day, but not political propaganda, but we need a healthier system. But I'm afraid we are starting to lose the San Francisco system as well. Now what we have, I think, sovereign states shrinking, then failed states, no international order at all, that sort of state of nature in Hobbesian terms. No rule at all, then the power. That's my observation. Thank you.
Good, good. Well, we've got a bit of a sort of pessimism of the intellect, optimism of the will thing going on this panel, I think. So we should probably close it down on that note. I know John wants to say thank you, but I'll say thank you first, if you don't mind, before you say thank you to whoever you have to say thank you to. I certainly have to say thank you to the audience for coming along for the panel, and of course to the panel for a decidedly so lively and engaging discussion. So if you join me in thanking us for this presentation.
Yes, no, I also wanted to also thank Emma Rees, who did such a good job of organising all of this over in the Cumberland department. And to people who came from far and wide, which is most of the panelists and for saying things that are actually quite difficult to say in public. So, thank you all and thank you very much for coming.